cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial again, or call your operator to help you. This is a recording.
70521.
Nous avons de la difficulté à établir la communication que vous avez demandée. Veuillez vérifier le numéro et composer de nouveau, ou demander l'aide du téléphoniste. Ce message est enregistré. 70521.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
And out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex. Where the hell is Alex?
He's delinquent.
No, seriously, where is Alex?
Alex is in parts unknown.
Guys, come on, get it together. We need to. I have so much to talk to Alex about tonight, and he's just not here. Can you reach out to him, please? Can you find him?
He informed us that he will not be able to join us this evening.
Did he? And
he
how
did.
Exactly did he do that?
He did that via email to our collective email.
Okay, this is ridiculous. Okay, fine. I guess we're on our own then. I had a ton of things to talk about, but now we have virtually nothing because somebody's being irresponsible. Okay, great. Maybe I should just leave too. You know, I'd like to do something else. All right, guys, take it away. No, I'm serious. I've had it. I really have.
Well, you know, there hasn't been much going on in the way of news, really, has there? It's been a very quiet week, slow week.
Quiet week. There's nothing really going on.
No. There is this LGTV story, which I found very interesting, in which a site that I have never heard of called Gamers Nexus, which is they make videos. They're one of those things. They did this deep dive into LG smart televisions, and what they found was pretty interesting. They used Wireshark to look at the information that these TVs send back and forth, and found that it actually collects a lot more data than people might be comfortable with. Retail LG OLED models, and this from a site called notebookcheck.net, Gamers Nexus tested retail LG OLED models, including the G5. Network packet captures taken through Wireshark showed the TVs actually scanning the local area network for unrelated hardware, including phones and smartwatches, things on the same LAN as the television. Apart from internal IP addresses, the sets also gathered the names and signal strengths of neighboring Wi-Fi networks, along with location data. It sampled on-screen audio and video into digital fingerprints to log what users watch across inputs. And new testing has shown that the data collection goes much further than just that. They found the TV could capture clean microphone audio while the screen was, or at least seems to be, powered down in standby mode. So you turn off your smart TV, and it is still listening to you and capturing audio of you and whatever's going on in your house. When the team disconnected the TV from Ethernet, the set continued saving voice input locally and uploaded the stored files once network access was restored. The researchers also documented some remote code execution vulnerabilities in WebOS. That's the OS that operates the television, because your television needs its own operating system.
Naturally.
The vulnerabilities are currently moving through the responsible disclosure process. As of this article on notebookcheck.net, LG hadn't commented on any of this. This moves on to another story on Ars Technica talking about this, which has a little more input back from LG. Find the bit here. They noted this is the TV's native functionality. This didn't require vulnerabilities for all this to happen. Even using an LG Smart TV, this is from the Ars Technica piece, as a dumb monitor doesn't necessarily stop all the functionality we're talking about, while pointing to broader implications for non-LG Smart TVs, because, of course, if one of the major manufacturers like LG is getting away with this sort of thing, it's obviously going to be something that the entire field, if they're not already doing, is going to be able to do. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm back. We're trying unsuccessfully to reach Alex, who apparently has just decided to bail on us. Okay, great, wonderful. So let's pick things up a bit. 9/11's coming up.
It's
the 25th anniversary of 9/11, and we don't want to talk about that, but of course we have to, because it's what everybody is focused on. It certainly is, you know, an important thing, obviously. But have we learned anything in 25 years? I don't think we have. In fact, I think we have spiraled even more into the drain. I'm hearing so much hatred, seeing so much ignorance, and realizing that we were actually in a better place under George W. Bush than we are 25 years later. I never could have predicted that. Technology-wise, yeah, we've advanced. We have faster connections, and we can see more video and wonderful things like that. But we live in a bizarro world. There's just no other way to describe it. As much as somebody could hope in 2001, I hope we could come together. The world could come together after the horrors of that day. I was scheduled to go on the air on September 11th, and I actually made it into the city from Long Island, where basically everything was closed going into Manhattan. I was able to drive up to somewhere in Queens, had to abandon the car on a side street, and get onto a bus make my way to Flushing. And from there, everything was free, too. There were no fares being charged. From there, make my way into Manhattan then have to walk all the way down, because nothing was running below 14th Street. Basically, what happened at that point was the station went off the air just almost exactly when I got there, because that final building collapsed and took a lot of power with it, wound up not being on the air that night or the week after. It was a bizarre day, let's put it that way, but something that has affected us every day since. Of course, we've had multiple wars since then. We've had all kinds of civil rights trampled upon. We've had We've just had a downward spiral. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. And now, you know, what we're looking at today, we are looking at such ignorance that there is a real push to keep Mayor Mamdani out of the September 11th ceremonies because he's Muslim. I mean, there's no other reason. If someone has a reason, or maybe he's socialist, well, we don't allow socialists to go to ceremonies. You know, you have idiots like the former Governor Pataki and super idiots like former Mayor Giuliani signing on to this petition. You have Ted Cruz in Texas giving his opinion that nobody asked for. And you just have this this atmosphere of hatred and ignorance. And I am just fed up with it. I'm fed up with this. We deserve so much better. We work so hard to get so much better. And look at us, 25 years later, in a world that is more intolerant, more filled with hatred and ignorance. I mean, Germany is welcoming back the Nazis. Wonderful. And all kinds of horrible things are happening. Protesters are massing in England against immigrants. You have a war criminal in Serbia being celebrated as a hero as he's buried. It, you know, I could go on and on. It's just really, really discouraging. And, you know, I hope that we can have an uplifting conversation. That's what I was hoping to do tonight, is have an uplifting conversation with those of us who showed up. So, I don't know. Kyle?
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, does the current state of affairs influence how we're looking at 2001? I'm really curious, because at the time and in the intervening time, there's these things like calls for unity and all of that. Here we have, like, complete DMZs, you know, we're completely split across party lines. There's so much keeping people apart, whether you're talking about information bubbles or silos where people just don't really, they're lacking information, you know, they're being told lies and believing them because they're aligned with things that they, other subjects they agree with. And I'm really, not as curious about recalling where I was that moment. We've done that years and years and years in a row. I'm weary of that. I don't need to remember where I was. I want to know where we're at now. How is that past instructing the present? I don't long wistfully for that period at all. It was awful. And it seems there's more terror than ever, as you pointed out.
Yeah. I mean, it was awful, but it's really awful now. It really is awful now. And I don't know if I wouldn't go back, you know, if I was offered the opportunity. Maybe, you know, to help not make the same mistakes all over again that led to the hell we're in right now. Yeah. Guys in Signal Land, anything?
I think about the immediate aftermath is more to think about. And, you know, Kyle, you're absolutely right. We've talked about where we were and how we were and all those things. And the thing that I think about a lot was some of the unifying stuff that we wound up talking about. My grandmother taped for me Pride and Prejudice. The BBC production of Pride and Prejudice was on A&E in October of 2001. And my grandmother heard I liked it, and she taped it for me, and it had commercials. And do you know how many of those commercials were PSAs with First Lady Laura Bush encouraging people to give blood? And I think about the opportunity that we could have had to figure out uniting in some way. Whereas now, I feel like the stratification of society, most people wouldn't pee on someone if they were on fire. And I don't know if I want to live in a country or a world where you wouldn't pee on someone who's on fire because you don't agree with them.
Okay, well, what country would pee on you if you were on fire? And I can't believe this is the question we're asking, but yeah, that's the measure. That's what we're shooting for.
I mean, I don't know what a pee country. Would Canada pee? I don't know.
Canada would pee, yes. Canada would pee. And Canada, we're so sorry. This, you had nothing to do with any of this. You are the least to be blamed for anything. And I just, you know, I hope that you realize that there are good people still in this country. And we will get rid of the other ones somehow so they're not in power anymore. And fix all of the things that are now broken.
Yeah, the thing I keep thinking of, and I've been thinking of this for 25 years or so now, when you're on a subway in the city, you regularly hear the announcement that backpacks and other large containers are subject to random search by the police.
Do you know I've never been searched?
Neither have I, but now that we said that, you know, karma's going to come and bite us in the butt. But the thing about that is I remember when that was new, as, you know, I'm sure most of us do, and it was put out there as something that's going to be happening now because everything's scary, but this is a temporary measure because we're in this heightened state of awareness. We are being extra careful right now, and so just for a bit, we're going to be doing this thing that, you know, a little bit earlier would have been unconscionably invasive, where we're just going to randomly search people because you happen to be riding the subway. Or I think the Long Island Railroad or other railroads for that matter. So you're using this public utility. You are subject to a random search. And that was a temporary measure. We are now on year 25 of this temporary measure because it was, you know, pushed through and accepted as something that's just part of the, it's part of life now. It's part of the background of being a person in the city who needs to ride a train. And it always made me so sad that we were willing to accept this, this chunk taken out of our, autonomy, our rights, with the trappings and excuse of, well, look at this terrible thing that just happened. You want to be part of what prevents that happening again, don't you? And we have just accepted it. And being more scared and being in this heightened state of quote-unquote security is just something that is the baseline now. And, you know, that's where we are. Because when rights are taken away, they are very seldom given back.
Bouncing right off of that, I'm thinking of, like, what do you think about the obligation that emerged, this sort of that we're obliged to participate in patriotism? Because that, I think, is a residue of that era that is prevalent now, and it's indoctrinated younger generations that did not exist during this tragedy. We're only emergent afterwards, and I look at it, and it's really hard to make sense of, because I don't accept it. Period. I think it's totally, like, as they say, performative, and it's like wildly just bizarre to me. And then I think of the sense of terrorism having been fixed through the things you're referring to also doesn't make sense to me, because it's not fixed, and the cost of that is giving up all of those rights you're talking about, and the unleashing of surveillance technologies. We are not talking about that any less. It's gotten worse. It's like got huge amounts of computing power behind it now, and people just seem more complacent than ever. No, I don't mean that. There are people that are pushing back specifically on data centers and flock cameras and all that, but there's a lot of our mainstream, the hegemonic folks out there that are going about and think, oh, that makes perfect sense that I have to submit to this, or I have to go through that line and this line and apply to this special global clear pass at an airport, or whatever it is. They just completely gobble it up and are, because of this background obligation to participate in enforced patriotism, because that was what the dominant culture at the time agreed was the response, or that was what unity was. It wasn't people establishing common cause across socioeconomic backgrounds or ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds. That wasn't it. It was just stand behind the flag and accept everything that's said in the name of this. And then you look at 20 years of fighting terror and all the bodies brought back from that. Our soldiers, I'm talking about veterans, who went out there in earnest serving their country, and then that failure, we look at it as a failure. Of course, it's blamed on Democrats, blamed on all kinds of people, except the people that designed it. And felt it would be great for, various defense contracts and, testing out new equipment and doing whatever else they did around that little sojourn in the Mideast, profit-seeking, who knows? But I find a real incongruence in my mind that we have to participate in all of this. We have to accept that culturally... we have to give up all sorts of things, and then anything under the auspices of terrorism is somehow legitimized if you label it terrorism. Now, that has taken form and branded all over the world by us. Anything, even domestically now, if you're considered, even thought of as a terrorist, if you wear black, if you cover up at a protest, you're a terrorist now. You're Antifa, and that's what we're calling terrorism. So it's when we wreak havoc and completely obliterate societies overseas under the auspices of terrorism, no matter how failed the plan is and what little results it yields, it doesn't do anything for asymmetric war or terrorism, and then all of a sudden it gets turned around and anybody who dares not participate in that patriotic theater, all of a sudden you're a terrorist. That's insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is so backwards. And that, to me, is the tangible result. That's what we're left with in the wake of this.
Right.
Yeah, if there's one thing the whole thing did, if there's one thing it achieved, it was making it very easy for those in power to say, well, look, here are some bad guys. You're not one of those, are you? You're one of the good guys, so you're doing what we tell you.
You're either with us or against us, I believe was the phrase used back then.
Yes.
And it still is. And
it still is, but it was coined then.
A lot of the things that are kind of a death by a thousand cuts in a lot of ways, and the things that we have become inured to accepting. And I think about kids starting back to school and needing clear backpacks because, God forbid, we do something about guns. No, we can't do anything about guns. We just need to make sure that everybody's carrying a clear bag so we can see if you have a gun in there, and then maybe we'll get to it before you shoot someone.
And so we also prepare our kids for the eventuality of them being shot to death in school, which doesn't mess them up too much, does it?
Exactly. Like, I remember, I grew up in the Midwest. We had tornado drills because that was a possibility. That was scary enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of lockdown drills, the idea of, you have to sit here silently for 60 minutes so that no one finds you. And, that all these pieces of security theater and performative concepts that were supposed to be temporary measures, and you still can't travel with a full-size bottle of body wash. What has happened that has made any of us safer? What has happened that has made, with the exception of a small cadre of oligarchs who are benefiting off everyone's paranoia mm-hmm. and fear, who is in a better situation than they were 25 years ago?
I'm impressed with the way you guys are expressing yourselves, and I'm glad that it turned out the way it did, because we need to say these things, and I encourage our listeners to also speak out in whatever forum they have. At 8 o'clock, that forum could be overtime, where you call us and say whatever is on your mind. But, Gila, let me just tell you that it's not as bad as you think, because they are allowing people to go to the gate again with people who are flying. So if you're accompanying somebody to an airport, you don't have to say goodbye at security. You, too, can go through security and go all the way down to the gate and then say goodbye to them as they get on the plane. That is freedom that we are getting back. We hard won, not in New York. You can't do that in New York. But other parts, if you apply in advance and pass the screening that you need before that, you use a TSA pre-check lane with an acceptable form of identification. The passes are valid for one day. Yeah, you can take that walk like you used to be able to take without a ticket. Personally, just buy a ticket, buy a refundable ticket, and then, you know, cash it in. I don't know. There's got to be a way to not use this program and walk down to the gate. Yeah, do you know a way, Gila?
Well, here's the thing. I have in the past had to get day passes to go to the gates to help chaperone unaccompanied minors between international flights and local flights. And, you know, super fun. Ride the air train to JFK at 5 o'clock in the morning, bump into teenagers on the autism spectrum who haven't slept in 3 days and need to maneuver them to a local flight. That has always existed. If you need, like, if there are certain circumstances where they're, well, where you can be allowed to get to the gate to accompany an unaccompanied minor or mm-hmm. someone who needs special assistance.
Yeah, that's run by the airlines. So I'm seeing here Delta, JetBlue, American Airlines, Southwest. They all issue their own gate passes on a case by case basis. This is a starting to get back to normal after 25 years. We can maybe have this, but not in New York. Yeah, we need to do a little bit more. But okay, so we have some information, some knowledge. I guess you'll call it whistleblowing of a sort, or just revealing the fact that for 25 years information has been kept from New Yorkers as far as the air quality after 9/11. And Mayor Mondani yesterday accused previous New York City leaders of lying about air quality safety after the September 11 terrorist attacks, which resulted in residents and workers developing serious illnesses years later. People got sick because the leaders they trusted lied and told them they were safe to breathe in toxic air, he said at a news conference at City Hall yesterday. As the years pass and the human toll grows, we reckon with the cost of September 11th, whenever another New Yorker is stolen from us too soon. 170,000 pages of documents are being released related to the toxic air quality around the site of the felled towers. He's not pointing the finger at particular leaders, but let's just say Rudy Giuliani was the mayor at the time of the attacks. Christine Todd Whitman, who was the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, they both reassured New Yorkers that the air above Ground Zero was safe to breathe. Safe to breathe. Now, either they were tremendously uninformed by the government that they were a part of, or they were lying. it's pretty simple. An audit from November 2001, based on information provided by the city's Department of Environmental Protection, confirmed there were elevated levels of the carcinogen benzene near Ground Zero that month, as well as increases in the concentration of ambient asbestos on Staten Island. 10 months after the attacks, asbestos was still being found around 15 John Street, which is a building less than a mile from the World Trade Center. These records were stored in 68 boxes in the city office, shielded from public view for more than two decades, and according to city officials, discovered only last year. Yeah, who knew? Who knew indeed? The release of the documents resolves a lawsuit that had demanded their release, filed by an advocacy organization known as 9/11 Health Watch, and over the next 12 years, city officials will be reviewing, redacting, making public many more records, That's according to the mayor and the city's lead lawyer, Stephen Banks. A spokesman for Giuliani did not respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for Mayor Bloomberg, who became mayor 4 months after the attacks, declined to comment. And I imagine the mayors that followed also have nothing to say right now. So, I don't know, what do you guys think about this? Is this obviously it's a good thing, right? We're not going to debate that. Any thoughts on it?
More information about what happened and what we all dealt with is a good thing. It is light. I think there aren't easy answers to this. I don't condone covering anything up. I think transparency is the way to go. But also, I'm forced to imagine, what if they told us at the time, on, you know, out in front of everyone in the media, that the air was not safe to breathe? What would have ensued? You know, people trying to evacuate, you know, 8 million and change people out of the city, people in the surrounding areas trying to find a way out, people on Long Island who, in order to get anywhere, would have to go through the city.
What else would you? Think of Chernobyl, you know?
Yeah.
When Chernobyl happened and we were pointing the finger at the Soviet Union saying, why aren't you telling people? It's mm-hmm. basically the same thing. You know, if you have a dangerous situation like that, you evacuate. Yeah, you move to a safer place until it's deemed safe to live in. Yeah, it's inconvenient as hell, but so is dying. And that, a lot of that could have been prevented had this been revealed. And, you know, I wish Alex were here because he'd find some way of blaming Mondani for this. But this is a good thing. I don't see how this could be seen as a bad thing to reveal this information and to point the finger and say, why didn't you tell us? And John Stewart was there, too. And he basically had the same perspective.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a good thing. I find myself really fascinated by just the thought experiment of that alternate universe in which they told people, no, it's not safe to be here now, and how that would have shaken out.
I wonder, would people have masked?
Well,
I'm not,
you know,
even joking.
You didn't have the Trumpers back then saying that, you know, masking, I don't know, was communist or whatever it was they accused people with masks of being woke, I guess.
But also the idea that, like, you know, I didn't live here then, but, you know, we're New Yorkers. We grit through anything. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, Superstorm Sandy's coming, so you tape your windows and batten down the hatches. I think that same kind of, if they had said, also, I'm sorry, you could see, right? Like, it was, there were particulates in the air.
Yeah, I was there that day. It was like after a snowstorm, you know, that quiet peacefulness, except it was horrible and hell. But, you know, all the cars were covered with ash.
Mm-hmm. So you could say, oh, this isn't going to go away that quickly. Mm-hmm. A mask might be. And, if they had been willing to talk about it, I could see that, you know. And the whole idea of pollution masking has happened in cities all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I strongly agree with the sentiment that Gil is talking here. Like, this is the kind of common sense. People would have just simply immediately begin wearing proper PPE. They would have been filtering exactly what eventually happened in hospitals and in schools and everything in the aftermath of COVID-19. Of course, some of that air is even harder to filter, but particulates, asbestos. I mean, I don't know how many people are really big fans of inhaling asbestos other than the asbestos lobby, but really, I think...
Hang on, is there still an asbestos lobby?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. There's a lobby for everything.
Oh, I want their address.
They mine, right? They mine it or something? I don't know. If we had the right information, people would have done that immediately. From the outset, and you wouldn't have long-term chronic illnesses that had occurred that then people are filing class action lawsuits and you have this enormously costly fund. They could have reduced, and I hate to put it in economic terms, but I am, it wouldn't have been as costly. The health, the amount of people that died after 9/11, I think John Seward indicated it's like three times as many in his press conference over this. It is about awareness and allowing people to take action, not necessarily evacuate, but if that's what they need to do because they have other respiratory illnesses, complicating factors, and they deem it necessary to leave, they would. They would because they would know better if they could at all. And perhaps we would have had shelters. We would have had satellite housing or alternatives for people that couldn't do it themselves. You know, we would have had a much more comprehensive emergency response if we knew certain areas were just really, really toxic. And a lot of those responders that were digging out the rubble, they were wearing masks and stuff too, but not in every single circumstance. Mm-hmm. They would remove them to take breaks. Maybe they would have been cycling through fresh filters a lot more frequently, not removing them until you're well away. I mean, I'm talking a commute away instead of, like, around the block if things are that bad. Or trucks moving debris have to be covered or wetted down, you know, like, eliminate the possibility for dust and cross-contamination. A whole lot of things, a whole cadre of things would have been prioritized that perhaps weren't.
Now, imagine if a whistleblower had gotten to this sooner and revealed this information. They'd be prosecuted for sure, but the information revealed was vital to be known, and it shouldn't have taken over two decades for people to find out about this. And it's just it's mind blowing that there are people out there who think keeping this quiet was the right thing to do. I just want to read a little bit more from this New York Times article. It's clear that city officials were aware that toxins had been detected in neighborhoods far removed from the World Trade Center. By September 14th, the city had set up a number of asbestos sampling sites, with one location in the East Village, more than a mile away. The asbestos levels detected there sometimes exceeded the city's threshold, according to an October 1st email. Yeah, they knew. At the time, Dr. Philip Landrigan was a professor of preventive medicine at Mount Sinai in Manhattan, which had a large program in occupational and environmental health. He noted that although city and federal officials set thresholds for asbestos concentrations in dust and air samples to deem which areas and buildings could be reoccupied, there is no such thing as a safe asbestos risk from a medical perspective. Asbestos exposure, he said, causes damage slowly over time. The pollutant that was most immediately harmful to people was the pulverized cement, he said, which received less public attention, but that researchers later identified to be the cause of World Trade Center cough, which is a severe and intractable cough experienced by rescue and recovery workers. Inhaling that dust from the World Trade Center was like inhaling Drano, he said. Joining Mondani at the news conference yesterday was the comedian John Stewart, as mentioned, who has become an outspoken advocate for the health of September 11 survivors. In his remarks, Stewart lamented the struggle it had taken to get people to understand what everyone seemed to know who lived in downtown Manhattan, that there was poison in the air and on the ground and in the windowsills and in your air conditioners and covering your pets and your clothes, and it stayed there for months. Everyone knew, he said. Thing is, you know, everyone knew who lived there, but everyone knew for sure who was in government, and that's the real shameful part of all this. So it's interesting that Mondani is a part of this, and people are going to sue the city because of these revelations, and he is the mayor of the city. So I imagine, you know, the last few mayors probably resisted doing that because they didn't want the city they were governing to be sued and potentially bankrupted. But, you know, at some point you have to do the right thing, and that might hurt things that you believe in and that you're a part of.
This is true, but I'm glad that he's doing what he's doing with this. It's a shame. It's terrible that it's taken this long for any of this to get, especially considering how many people there must have been involved in these studies and these tests, and you know how many names are on the stuff in those file cabinets of people who could have, at some point in the last 25 years, if they're still with us, have said something to someone. It is amazing to think about this being revealed after this long. It is also depressing, but somehow hopeful.
Now, I know these were stored in, 68 boxes somewhere, but they could have just as easily been stored online. And the question I'd like to pose to the hacker community, if you stumbled upon this online, this information, what would you do? Would you reveal it? Would you back away and pretend you never saw it? Would you face the almost certain possibility that you would somehow be blamed for causing turmoil and, in all likelihood, sent to prison, because that's the world we live in right now? It's a tough choice, but, you know, we do have access to things. We all have access to things that are of interest to other parties. And at some point, we have to make a decision in our minds as to whether it's worth the risk to share this with people who need to know about it. I'm not talking about state secrets, not talking about espionage or anything like that. I'm talking about this kind of thing, you know, things that affect your health, things people have a right to know, unless there are people who believe that we don't have the right to know this. I'm sure there are. We live in a crazy time where that side would be equally represented on CNN. But I like to tell myself that there is still a chance for sanity in this world, despite results of elections and anti-immigrant rallies and all kinds of other ugliness. I like to think decency will prevail, sanity will prevail, and you know, we need to get together, have conversations, accept ourselves, accept our differences, and not look to demonize, not look to form factions. And, you know, figure out who the bad guys really are and unite against them. That's what I hope.
You know, that makes me think about the efforts there have been when there have been caches of data of interest to the public made available online, and the community that rallies around investigating this stuff, poring over this stuff. You know, how many members of the hacker community were involved in not only publishing what's known as the Epstein files, but then taking all that data and going through it bit by bit, looking for important things. And if we could do that in a case around, you know, one rich rapist who is not going to get any more punishment because he's dead, what can we do with something of use and value to so many, and, you know, of such importance to history and the present day?
Yeah, you know, we've talked on the other show about how disappointing it is, the reaction to all the horrible things that are going on, the kidnappings, the killings, the overall sense of fear, anti-science, anti-education, anti-certain types of people. And we just seem to take it, you know. We have to not miss work. We have to, you know, struggle to get by. And we occasionally, every few months, have a two-hour demonstration and feel good about that. Yeah, we're not doing enough, clearly. You know, I forget where I was going with this, but we basically have we need a sense of accomplishment. We need to know that we are getting something done, pissing off the right people. And I think the way to do that is to reveal the information that makes them squirm. And that's where the leaks come in. That's where revelations come in, where, you know, you basically dump the data and people see it for themselves. And then maybe they react and do something and prevent this from continuing. But nothing happens with the status quo. Nothing happens if we just sit back and see what's going to happen next. What's Trump going to rename next? I mean, New America. Oh, yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. But, you know, we're not changing anything by just saying, hey, did you see what he did today?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a combination of those things, like whistleblowing, sure, leaks. That are anonymous or otherwise great, you know, long-form investigative journalism, brilliant. But we really have to collectively add to all of that. It has to be this sort of joyfulness in all of it being organized and distributed and shared widely in to sort of sidestep a lot of the contained sort of information spheres people are in. And I think pressure, like a lot of pressure on mainstream media outlets, as uncredible as they've become, whether through derision or through their own actions and various consolidative forces, shall we say, the ownership issues around mainstream media sources is a serious problem. But we still have the ability to put pressure on what kind of content is, quote, feel good. You know, I think we should, there's a lot we should feel good about and be sharing instead of, you know, the pleasant, happy stories that we can recast a lot of the successes that opposition and resistance is having as a sort of feel-good story. And the good feeling is when it culminates in actual change and action that can change the trajectory that we're looking at, which is really awful. And that kind of pressure also should be put on these tech companies. Google, straight up.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Apple, Meta, all of them.
Uh-huh.
They are doing a very bad job. Every single one of those million-dollar donors at his inauguration needs to be put on.
Mm-hmm.
Notice, blast, whatever you want to call it, what they're doing is un-American. They're lying. They're lying for liars, and we're sitting around bankrolling their innovation and their existence. It's not just reform,
yeah,
regulation, and all of that. It needs to be all forms of strike. People, I've said this this week a lot, I think it's good to be optimistic, be active politically, but we need to be planning for a general strike. Provision, get yourself ready, because we will have to slowly assemble that if things do not go well and they get progressively worse with more liars and more capitulation by large corporations.
And all power to MapQuest. Go ahead, Gila, quickly.
There was something I did want to mention, because I don't know if you know about this
you have one
midterm convention that the Republicans decided to have.
I heard about that today.
Right,
I heard about that today.
Did you hear about the website?
No. Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay.
I did hear about a fake website.
Yes. So someone basically cyber squatted on a connected term. And if you visit GOPDallas2026.com, it's a redirect to the Epstein files, which I thought was a really nice little zest.
See, we need to do more things like that. And, you know, what Kyle was saying before about, you know, feel-good stories, but also feeling good. I want people to think about the things that make them feel, I don't know, like they're not wasting time. If you hear a particularly good lecture or see a particularly good comedy show or something that just makes you feel like you're not alone, you're with educated people and people who have spirit and courage and won't just bow down and do what they're told, acknowledge that, share that, make sure more people get to be a part of that. I'm hoping that we are doing that for some people. Please, oth@2600.com, our email address if we are.
Stop scrolling. Talk to real people. Just please share in the dialogue. Get ideas. Be creative. We are really at a deficit of creativity, and we have an abundance. I mean, people are doing a lot with music and art, and I love that. It's a great escape. It's a great way to express certain feelings through fiction or whatever. But we need to be creative in our action and
Absolutely.
In how we organize what we're getting. If you hear one story or just one or two things, how does it all fit together?
Yeah.
And how are we organizing it and getting it distributed widely?
And it's not just about the people with the most follows, the most likes or whatever. It's all of us. We can all be a part of this. So let's listen to each other. Let's be a part of it. Let's encourage each other. And we're going to get through this thing. And I hope we all remember on September 11th all the tragedy that has come about as a result of that. And let's prevent the next one, prevent the ongoing ones. We'll see you next week. We'll see you at 8 o'clock on YouTube, channel 2600. Good night.
Here comes the helicopter. Second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many